This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
This world was topsy-turvy, and people of renown were doing the most peculiar things as the world turned upside down. I dreamt all men were equal, and there were no starving poor, and nations never did quarrel, nor never went to war. I dreamt all men were angels, and women there wore a frown. Old maids, they had large families, as the world turned upside down.
You noble diggers, all stand up now, stand up now. You noble diggers, all stand up now. The wasteland to maintain, seen cavaliers by name, your digging does maintain, and persons all defame. Stand up now, with spades and hoes and ploughs. Stand up now, with spades and hoes and ploughs. Stand up now. Your freedom to uphold, seen cavaliers are bold, to kill you if they could, and rights from you to hold. Stand up now, diggers all.
The lawyers they conjoin, stand up now, the lawyers they conjoin, stand up now.
To arrest you they advise, such fury they devise, the devil in them lies, and have blinded both their eyes. Stand up now, the clergy they come in, stand up now, the clergy they come in, stand up now. The clergy they come in and say it is a sin, that we should now begin our freedom for to win. Stand up now, diggers all. The gentry are all round, stand up now, the gentry are all round, stand up now. The gentry are all round, on each side they are found, their wisdom so profound, to cheat us of our ground. Stand up now, the club is all their law, stand up now, the club is all their law, stand up now. The club is all their law, to keep poor men in awe, that they no vision saw, to maintain such a law. Stand up now, diggers all.
All right, opening up with a little Chumbawamba here on the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. On listener-supported, non-commercial, WBAI 99.5 FM, performing a song that was on the Top of the Pops back in 1649 by a band called Gerard Winstanley and the Diggers. And today was, or continues to be, if you're like me and you think that the day begins at dawn, July 14th, Bastille Day. But we are not talking about the French Revolution of 1789 tonight, but about that important and lesser-known precursor struggle exactly 140 years earlier, the English Revolution. And here joining us live by telephone from Oakland, California, is our good friend, independent radical scholar and organic intellectual, Louis Finzel. You there, Lou?
Yeah, I'm here. Hello.
Hey, how's the weather out in Oakland?
Hot day today. It's cooling down now.
Glad to hear it. So are you wearing a particular hat tonight, Lou, or are you here merely as an individual?
Yeah, I'll just be an individual.
Okay, good. So I understand, me too, that makes two of us. I understand you've been on the hustings, as it were, with a presentation that you're calling Can We Still Turn the World Upside Down? Lessons from 1649.
Yeah, I first, I'm part of something called the Institute for the Critical Study of Society, and I lectured there, gave a lecture on Blake, and I thought, well, what else am I excited about? And I remembered Gerard Winstanley. And then I'd actually given a lecture on Rabelais at an anarchist conference, and they invited me to do something in Santa Cruz at another anarchist conference, and I thought, well, I'm already brushing up on the English Civil War Revolution, so it's interesting to talk to a group. The first group's mostly Marxists, and the second group was all anarchists. I decided for the anarchists that I was going to proclaim that anarchist direct action began on April 1st, 1649.
Right on. At St. George's Hill.
Yeah, yeah. And then I found an interesting book that said exactly that. It's by someone named George Woodcock.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Anarchism, A History of Libertarian Ideas and Movements. Chapter 2 is called The Family Tree, and it's interesting. He talks about Lao Tzu and Rabelais and different people. And then he says, well, the first real anarchist direct action was Gerard Winstanley. And, you know, I think, to me, we still want to do the same thing. Are you familiar with a book by Starhawk called The Fifth Sacred Thing?
Yes, I've seen it. I haven't actually read it.
So it's sort of the near future, and there's been a revolution, and Northern California has sort of got autonomy, although it's under threat. And the whole thing happens.
Now, I always get that book confused with a similar one by Ursula K. Le Guin, right, which is also set in some sort of utopian California near future. And
okay, well, it's actually another planet.
No, I'm not thinking of The Dispossessed, which is really great book.
Because
it's a later one.
She wrote a sort of prequel to the Dispossessed.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
What was that called?
Which is it's actually just a sort of short story, and that also talks about how the revolution broke out. I don't remember it so well.
Hmm.
But in Starhawk's book, the thing happens when these old women, well, it used to be called Army Street. It's now Cesar Chavez Street, but in her book, it's Army Street. And
San Francisco.
Yeah, and they go out with pickaxes and start tearing up the streets so they can start doing the organic gardening and what. And
uh-huh.
Huge. And so that's still our paradigm, I think. I mean, that's still what I want to do, and it seems like this economic crisis is dragging on, and I'm waiting to see when young anarchists are going to bust loose and say, get rid of this concrete. The One Digger song is talking about to make the wastelands grow, and I think we have a different idea what the wastelands are now. There are parking lots and cement everywhere.
Yup. Yeah, we got that song on the Chumbawamba disc you sent me, too. We'll play that later.
Yeah, yeah, great.
And I've also got the Leon Rosselson version of the same song. So, that's not on the Chumbawamba disc. That's a later song.
No, it's the same title, but it's a different song.
Exactly, right. In fact, the one that we opened with is entitled The World Turned Upside Down, which was apparently written in the 19th century. And then we immediately went into the Diggers song, which, now that song, I don't know if the music survived, but the lyrics at least were actually written by Winstanley back in 1649, correct?
Yeah, yeah, they definitely sang that on St. George's Hill. Halfway through the summer, they moved to a different hill, and they got their butts kicked, by the way.
Yes, eventually they did get their butts kicked very bad.
There's an interesting, we should mention the author Christopher Hill. And his famous book is called The World Turned Upside Down, Radical Ideas in the English Revolution.
Yes, indeed.
There's another book called The Experience of Defeat.
Hmm, that one I don't know.
And it runs through the different radical tendencies, and the left wing of Cromwell's army were called the Levelers, and they wanted democracy for everyone. You wouldn't even have to, they weren't thinking women could vote, but you wouldn't have to own property to vote. So Cromwell basically kept a lid on the revolution. But the Levelers, I mean, they were armed. I mean, they that was the best chance for the revolution, really, not being contained. They were already defeated by the time Gerard Winstanley rose up.
The Levelers.
Yes.
Well, they were sort of purged. They had made up the backbone of Cromwell's army, and then there was a purge.
Right. Yeah. A lot of them were sent to Ireland. The army was being broken up, and to a certain extent, by the Parliament, and there was issues of back pay and things like this. But they had some. They were about as radical as Tom Paine, I would say. So they're pretty radical.
Right. Well, maybe we should back up a little bit here. For people who are not familiar with the history, the English Civil War began in 1642, if memory serves, where there was a showdown between the Parliament and King Charles II over who was going to control the army. That was the actual spark which set off the conflict.
I mean, the conflict was to talk about the history, it's hard to know if this started in the 1620s or 1605, or there's all kinds of... And I've done a lot of reading on this period, and it's, you know, I'm sure a lot of, like, even British school kids understand it better than me. I mean, there was the Short Parliament, the Long Parliament.
Right.
There was one called the Bare Bones Parliament.
That's right.
There was one called the Rump.
Yes.
And that was coined by some right-wing... you know, aristocracy, but it's pretty funny. You got to love it. The Rump Parliament.
Yeah, well, basically, it got very confused. It started out sort of as a conflict between the monarchy and the old, you know, conservative feudalistic order, and according to the official history, you know, the up-and-coming bourgeoisie who wanted greater freedom and free trade and all that sort of thing. And basically, once the war opened up in 1642, there were all these factions which sort of jumped into the fray, and there were big religious overtones to it on both sides, because you had the Anglicans were backing the monarchy, and the Puritans were backing Cromwell and the rebels. And almost all of the people in Cromwell's camps were Puritans. But that's kind of this big catchphrase, which encompassed all sorts of different tendencies. And then you also had the Presbyterians and the Catholics, who were on either side at various times.
Well, it's really interesting, because people try and think of it. It wasn't, people of all classes were on both sides of this thing. In fact, the leader of one big battle, gosh, I can't think of the name of the battle now. It's sort of a turning point in history in a way. And the general for the Parliament was Lord Fairfax.
Right.
He outranked Cromwell at that point, but he was really getting pretty war-weary, and he kind of let Cromwell go nuts. So, you know, I want to bring in a little... almost personal history to this.
Mm-hmm.
And have you ever read The 18th Brumaire by Karl Marx?
Of course.
So he's talking about how revolutions dress up in costumes of previous eras. Like, he talks about the French Revolution, and the revolutionaries are having a big toga party, and they're, in their minds, they're reviving the Roman Republic.
Indeed.
So then he goes on to say, in like manner, more than a century earlier, and in another phase of development, Cromwell and the English people had borrowed the phraseology, the emotions, and the illusions of the Old Testament as trappings for their own bourgeois revolution. As soon as they had reached the goal, as soon as the bourgeois transformation of English society had been effected, Locke supplanted Habakkuk.
I'm sorry, run that by us again.
Okay, you know the philosopher Locke?
Yes.
Okay, Habakkuk apparently is some... Old Testament prophet that I'm not familiar
mm-hmm.
with. But so, I mean, in my life, I've seen people reach for the diggers. In the 60s, there was a radical group, Emmett Grogan and Peter Berg.
Yep.
They came out of the San Francisco Mime Troupe.
And they were also on New York's
the diggers.
They were also in New York's Lower East Side for a while.
So I was talking to Michael Delacour, one of the founders of People's Park, And I was talking about the 1640s diggers, but I said, were you guys thinking of the diggers when you did your thing at People's Park, when you made your move? And he said, oh, yeah, we knew that the diggers were doing stuff on the peninsula. So he thought I was talking about the...
Right.
And apparently they were doing some reclamation thing down, I don't know, in near, I don't know where, Stanford, near Stanford or Palo Alto or somewhere. But I'd like to sing you a little bit of the song. This is this song was the marching song of Oliver Cromwell's army.
Okay.
Let's see how it goes. Babylon has fallen, fallen, fallen. Babylon has fallen to rise no more. It goes on like that. But, you know, I mean, then you have reggae. Babylon is gone, fall down, fall down. Babylon is gone, fall down.
So where did you get the Oliver Cromwell marching tune?
Well, you know, have you seen this movie called Win Stanley that came out in the mid-70s?
I never did see it, no.
And they show Cromwell's army marching along, singing that. And I heard that song years before, like a bluegrass version of it.
Hmm.
So, I mean, that song's still, and this was from, song was, the version I first heard was from the 1940s or something.
Hmm.
But, so, People's Park, then we had another big battle over People's Park in the 90s.
Right. Well, the first big battle was, what, 1969?
Yeah, yeah.
That was when the park was first established. It was reclaimed.
Yeah, and it from was definitely a, just the
what,
same.
What had been a University of California parking lot, and the hippies came in and planted flowers and trees.
I mean, at first it had been a thriving neighborhood.
Right.
And it was a pretty radical neighborhood. And the University of California, as an entity of the state of California, said, oh, we need dorms or some such. And they got eminent domain declared. They tore down all the houses and apartment buildings. And then they just left it there as really nothing. I mean, I don't think they were even using it for parking. I think there was broken glass and syringes and things. And people just said, this is wrong. And we have another vision. And let's reclaim it.
Right. And indeed they did. And it's still there today as a park.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yep. Still going.
And as a not an official city park, but a sort of a special kind of park under a program of user development.
Well.
Ostensibly, anyway, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, at least it's still there. In fact, there is a lot of user development. There's some really fantastic gardens going on, all kinds of native plants and things, and that is all volunteer labor.
Mm-hmm.
And then every once in a while, the city will go nuts and say, drug dealers hid behind this branch, and
right.
So we have to, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And there was, the early 90s, there was parallel to our struggle here in New York City over Tompkins Square Park. At the same time, there was a struggle in People's Park over the university's plan to take back some of the land for a volleyball court.
Well, they put in the volleyball court, and so many of us were arrested over big hassles around that volleyball court, and we actually have a chainsaw as an emblem. Some of the Earth Firsters are confused. Why do you have this chainsaw? But we use the guy's not alive anymore. Bob Sparks chopped down
right.
The center pole of the volleyball court with the chainsaw.
Right. And is the volleyball court still there?
No, it's been removed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And a basketball court was put in, and people protested and arrested that too. But that is actually a people sport.
Yes.
An actual real people instead of like. Anyhow,
yeah.
So, and we wanted to build the bathroom, but the university put in a bathroom. And the Digger song is by Leon Rosselson is emblazoned on the front of it because we were reaching for the diggers in the early 90s too.
Oh yeah, the lyrics of the Leon Rosselson song about the diggers. Entitled The World Turned Upside Down.
1649, St. George's Hill, a ragged band they called the Diggers came to work the people's will.
Yeah, we'll play it later.
Yeah, we definitely should. You know, when I first heard that song, I realized I was a communist. The sin of property we do disdain. God, when I just heard that, it just made my hair stand on end.
And when was that, Lou? How long ago?
Oh, I don't know. It was probably in the mid-80s.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure when he wrote the song. It probably came out in the early 80s, I think. I'm not really sure.
So why don't we get back to the 1649 tip here? So
okay.
The king has just been executed in 1649. King Charles II, they just chopped his head off.
So what happened was there were actually two civil wars. There was a civil war, and it was a big mess, and the king said, okay. And then he basically got his army back together and started another civil war.
Right, and that turning point battle, I believe, according to the internet, was the Battle of Naseby. Does that sound right to you? Yeah, June 14th. 1645.
I have this book, Great Battlefields of the World, and it has 50 battles, and that's one of them.
Mm-hmm.
I'll have to show it to you sometime.
Okay.
So the army got hold of him, and...
Meaning Oliver Cromwell's new model army.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And people were really angry with him for starting up the war again.
Yes.
And, so, I mean, this is pretty impressive. Like you say, way before the guillotine and everything. Chop off the king's head.
Right.
I mean, it really shocked the world. Let me read a little more. So I read that little bit from Marx. Okay, here's something. On 20th April 1649, the Digger leaders, Gerard Winstanley and William Everard, met with General Fairfax to explain their reasons for taking over the common land at St. George's Hill earlier that month. After both refused to remove their hats, Everard acted as spokesperson for the movement. So this strange guy, Everard, who didn't, he's kind of a, not really a stable guy, but he was helping Gerard Winstanley quite a bit at the beginning. Everard said he was of the race of the Jews, that all the liberties of the people were lost by the coming in of William the Conqueror, and that ever since, the people of God had lived under tyranny and oppression, worse than that of our forefathers under the Egyptians. But now the time of deliverance was at hand, and God would bring his people out of this slavery, and restore them to their freedom, enjoying the fruits and benefits of the earth. And that there had lately appeared to him a vision which bade him arise and dig and plow the earth and receive the fruits thereof, that their intent is to restore the creation to its former condition. And then just a little bit more from...
What text were you just reading from?
This is some flyer I made out to hand out, and it's got... It's very excessive, and I got it from 10 or 20 different books, and I really don't know at this point.
Okay, but that was an original Digger text from 1649?
I mean, that was the speech that was reported that this guy Everard made to General Fairfax.
Mm-hmm. And this is one
made a big deal about, now that the king's gone, we're free Anglo-Saxons again, and all our liberties from before the Norman invasion are back.
Yes, right. But
they were really big on that.
Right, that was a big part of their rhetoric.
But what's interesting,
the whole British Israelite angle, that's...
Right, it's William Blake. We'll build Jerusalem in England.
Right, but two centuries before Blake.
Yeah, but this big continuous tradition.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So just a little bit more from Marx. Thus, in the great French Revolution and the British Revolution of the 17th century, the calling up of the shades of the dead took place in order to embellish the new struggles, and not in order to parody the old. It was done for the sake of adding an imaginative halo to the task that had to be performed, and not in search of an excuse from refraining from their actual performance. There was a genuine endeavor to rediscover the spirit of revolution, and not the mere making of a ghost to walk. So that's how it always is. I mean, even in Iran, a lot of the people there are thinking, we're picking up in 79.
Yes.
It got derailed.
Right, and saying...
What's the shout from the
Allahu Akbar.
Rooftops? Right.
Allahu Akbar.
So, I mean, that's how it really has to be done, I think. And my point in being interested in 1649 is that I think the mentality... Well, I was bringing up reggae music. In the early 80s, I was wearing my hair in dreads and getting in, doing every possible protest and getting in fights with cops and all kinds of things. And people would say, why is your hair like that? And I would start talking about John the Baptist and Elijah and Samson. And it was kind of strange because at the same time, I was getting initiated into the Aleister Crowley cult and Babylon was our goddess. But there was something prophetic about Bob Marley. I mean, at least I wasn't, you know, talking Yaman and saying Irie and stuff like that. So, I mean, I don't even know. This is my tinfoil hat, but I can imagine Marley being killed as a third world messiah by the CIA or something. We got to stop this guy.
That is a little tinfoil hat, but...
Okay, well...
But not impossible, I suppose.
So I think the mentality in this country, if there is ever any kind of revolution, there's going to be people on our side that are going to be thinking in terms of the Book of Revelations? And
well, you know, I'd like to sort of bring the conversation around to that at a little later, because I mean, there are certain parallels between the situation in contemporary America and that in England in the during the English Civil Wars. And one of them is that, you know, I mean, England was kind of divided between what we might call Blue England and Red England, right?
I mean, sure.
I mean, there was Blue England, which was mostly in the southeast around London, which, you know, supported Cromwell. And then you had Red England, which was mostly out in the boondocks in the western and northern parts of the country, which supported the monarchy. And that was pretty much the dividing lines of the war for a couple of years until finally Cromwell established his control throughout the country. And then the royalists were left to make alliances with the Dutch and the Scottish and the Irish in order to invade England and get their proverbial behinds handed to them once again. So, but the interesting thing is that, you know, as in the French Revolution, it was a case of the have a little want mores exploiting the have-nots, right, in order to achieve their aims. It was, you know, the up-and-coming bourgeoisie using the proletarians as cannon fodder.
Yeah.
You know, at least that's the traditional version of the history, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, and the levelers were a, you know, a pretty clear example of that. I mean, they were really thoroughgoing revolutionaries who were sort of co-opted into Cromwell's army and used against the royalists and to put down the insurrection in Ireland with great brutality until finally they had outlived their usefulness and had become more of a threat to Cromwell than anything else, and they were purged and put down themselves quite bloodily late in the day, just before Cromwell's own death in, I believe, 1649 or 1650, right?
Yeah, yeah. A little bit later than that.
Yeah.
And they tried
yeah.
to put in Cromwell's son.
Yes.
He was called Tumbledown Dick because he lasted about a week or a month or something.
Right.
And the Parliament actually voted to bring Charles II, the son of Charles.
Right, so who actually did return in 1660.
Yeah. So they still haven't got their republic back.
Well, yeah, but there were some compromises which were worked out when Charles II came in. His power was curtailed somewhat, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and particularly, I think, you know, Parliament maintained control of the army, which had been the source of the original dispute. Anyway, all of this would, you know, continue to fester for centuries to come, quite obviously, right? You had the Glorious Revolution and the Jacobite Revolt and...
Oh, yeah, the 1790s were a very intense period.
Yes.
So I want to read you this little bit. I think I got this out of The World Turned Upside Down by Christopher Hill. This is about this astrologer, Lilly. Lilly specialized in applying old predictions to the circumstances of the revolutionary decades. His prophecy of the White King elaborated on a prediction attributed to Merlin. Lilly's repeated prophecies of a restraint on monarchical power, his call, on strict astrological grounds, for Charles I and the Oxford Parliament to return to Westminster, his repeated predictions of defeat and a violent end for the king, may have contributed to bring about these effects. It was a fortunate coincidence for Lilly that his prophecy of disaster for Charles was published on the day of the Battle of Naseby.
Ah.
So here's an interesting thing about this, the prophecies of Merlin. So Blake in the 1790s writes a little thing called Merlin's Prophecy. The king and the priest must be tied in a tether. When two virginities meet together, the harvest will flourish in wintry weather when two virgins meet together. So then you have John Lennon and Yoko Ono putting out that record called Two Virgins.
Mm-hmm. Is there a connection there? You think?
Oh, yeah. Lennon was a huge Blake freak.
Uh-huh.
So this prophecy of Merlin stuff, is going on in the 1640s, and Blake's picking up on it in the 1790s, and Lenin's picking up on the same kind of radical currents in the late 60s.
Hmm. All right. And, so can you elaborate a bit on what Blake meant by two virgins?
Well, you know, it's poetry. It's about innocence and experience. And, you know, if you're innocent, you see the emperor has no clothes.
And that's exactly what John and Yoko were on the cover of that album.
Yeah, yeah.
No clothes. Full frontal is very radical for, what was it, 1968 or thereabouts?
Yeah, they were, I mean, you could see their cheeks, too. They were, you kind of had a little of, they were kind of holding hands, sort of facing the camera, sort of walking away from the camera. Beautiful picture. I think, I don't know how many got out before it was recalled.
Yes.
So it's quite a collector's item.
Well, we should say that it is 12:30 in the morning here on listener-supported non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. My name is Bill Weinberg. This is the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade, and we are speaking with Lou Finzel, who is joining us by telephone from Oakland, California, to share with us some of his research and explorations into the events of 1649 and the English Revolution and their continuing relevance. So the phrase, world turned upside down, we already heard one song. We opened the show with a song from a traditional English folk song from the 19th century of that phrase, and pretty soon we're going to hear the Leon Rosselson song with the same name, and we've also mentioned the Christopher Hill book, The World Turned Upside Down. Now, where does the phrase originate?
Well, you know, Gerard Winstanley, there's a historical fiction about him that I haven't been able to find. It's called Freedom is the Man.
Hmm.
Gerard Winstanley says, freedom is the man who will turn the world upside down. But no wonder he's going to have lots of enemies. So he definitely used the phrase. I mean, it probably went back to the Middle Ages as well. There's all kinds of topsy-turviness. And I found some collection of American Revolutionary War songs, and there was a world turned upside down, completely different song in that one as well.
Oh, indeed.
But I mean, it's a lot. If you read,
you'll have to
get
that to me for
Carnival
airplane
and things like that. Turning the world upside down, you know, at least for a day on Carnival.
Yes,
it's a medieval kind of thing.
Mm.
But yeah, Gerard Winstanley definitely knew he was trying to turn the world upside down. He used that phrase.
Okay, so the Diggers called themselves the True Levelers, as distinct from the Levelers who were sort of co-opted by Cromwell.
Yeah, they rejected that title, but Winstanley, his banner was the earth a common treasury for all, and he thought there should be no rich or poor, so that's leveling. No mountains or valleys, just one flat playing field.
Oh, when you say he rejected that title, he rejected which title?
The Levelers rejected the title Levelers.
Right, but yes, originally,
Winstanley
yes,
claimed it
yes,
and said, yes, we're the true Levelers.
Right,
we
right,
really
right,
mean
right.
it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Although history has called them the Levelers, even though
right,
they at
right.
the time sort of rejected the title.
Yeah, now, it was so widespread. You know, we should also talk about the Ranters. They
indeed.
Were kind of a lot of fun.
Right. I mean, if I had been around back then, I definitely would have been with the Ranters. Tell us about
Gerard Winstanley had some trouble with the Ranters.
Tell us.
Let me read this. A couple things. I'm not sure where this is from. The Ranters formed the extreme left wing of the sects which came into prominence during the English Revolution, both theologically and politically. It's pretty strange. Theologically, these sects lay between the poles of Orthodox Calvinism, with its emphasis on the power and justice of God, as illustrated in the grand scheme of election and reprobation, with its insistence upon the reality of hell in all its most literal horrors, and upon the most verbal and dogmatic acceptance of the scriptures, and of antinomianism, with its emphasis upon God's mercy and universality, its rejection of the moral law, and with it of hell in any but the most figurative sense, and its replacement of the authority of the scriptures by that of the inner light. The Ranters pushed all these beliefs to, and sometimes even a little beyond, their furthest logical conclusions. So this would be a typical Ranter thing.
All right, now
the rich people.
Once again,
saying,
you're reading from what now?
I don't know.
You don't know.
From my flyer.
All right. So, but you, when you say your flyer, I mean, you didn't write it. You cut and paste from.
No, I put together this weird mosaic of all this to hand out at my lectures.
Oh, you'll have to mail me a copy.
Okay. Yeah, I will. So the rich Calvinist said, well, clearly this is a sign of grace that, you know, we dress so nice and we own everything. We're the saved. So the ranters, I mean, predestination is really bothersome. I mean, it can really get to you. It can really make you despair.
Yes.
And the ranters came up with, they were, when you could do a sin, anything conceived of as sin, as no sin, that's proof that you're saved.
Hmm.
Now, their main thing was adultery.
Oh?
Oh, I can make love to dude's wife, and I don't feel guilty about it at all. That means I'm saved. It's a clear sign from God. So that was the kind of thing they were into. And basically, they thought, all my impulses are from God. Huh. And I'm saved, and there is no sin for me.
Well, this is sort of in the same tradition as, very, very broadly speaking, as Tantrism. And what was the cult which Hieronymus Bosch, the painter, was supposed to have belonged to?
Well, they say he was a secret Cathar, or Albigensian.
Hmm.
Because some of them had fled. I think it was a branch that was in Germany and not southern France, but they'd fled to Holland or Belgium or wherever it was.
Right, and called themselves something like the Brotherhood of Love or something.
Well, okay, that was more of a German thing, the Brethren of the Free Spirit.
There you go.
Yeah, and it's strange because you had
who believed in free love, apparently. Although it's contested whether Hieronymus Bosch was actually a member.
I mean, there's evidence from some of his paintings because the Cathars or the Albigensians, they had this ritual where they'd put the New Testament on your head. And there's a scene, that all the mysterious scenes going on in Bosch's paintings, people thought, oh, why has that woman got the book on her head? And there's all kinds of interpretations possible that would link Hieronymus Bosch to the underground Cathar church.
Mm. And the whole notion was sort of getting back to this pure Edenic state before the fall, before sex was sinful.
I mean, it's strange because sometimes it goes back to the Gnostics, and sometimes there's extreme dualism where the entire material plane is evil, and the creator, who straight people worship as God, is really the devil. So then, the Ten Commandments, they're actually all from the devil. And what you do in the material plane doesn't matter anyways, although some of them would say, do anything except reproduce, because then you're trapping the sparks of light into the material plane. So then they'd have various forms of sex that wouldn't involve pregnancy.
Ah, indeed. Okay, well,
some of them would be Simon of the Desert types, you know, just everything, just mortify the flesh, period. So different extremes are possible. And then it also merges into pantheism, which is strange because dualism says that this world is complete, God is completely absent from this world.
Yes.
And then pantheism says that God is everywhere.
Yes, in the material world.
And the ranters could have both of these ideas at the same time.
Hmm. Okay, well, do you think that there was any possible sort of intellectual continuity? I mean, actually handing down the doctrine in at least in different forms, an actual evolution going back from, you know, the ranters to the Gnostics?
I do, yeah. Hmm. But, I mean, if someone can think of it in the 2nd century A.D., you know, then someone can think of it in the 1640s, too.
Right, but
And Blake thought of it in the 1790s.
But what if any, would be the hypothetical line of transmission between the medieval Gnostics?
You'd have the Gnostics, and it would go into alchemy, and it would go into the Rosicrucians, and, you know, even Freemasonry.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there would just be so many different possible paths.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Protestant Reformation, that was just a heresy that succeeded because they keep popping up and the church keeps smashing them down. And that one was just too big to smash down.
Right.
And even that had its various... Oh, who was that guy that led that peasant rebellion?
Which one?
The one, he was contemporary with Martin Luther.
The German Peasant Rebellion.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll look it up.
Munzer?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Mm-hmm,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Who Engels wrote about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really interesting to see what Bible versus those guys like. Winstanley really likes something in Acts of the Apostles, and the apostles are communists, and they just said they shared everything. They had no personal possessions whatsoever.
You'll have to get me chapter and verse on that.
Well, yeah, I mean, my plan is to become a Bible expert, but it's been 10 years now since I resolved this, and I'm not really any kind of Bible expert as far as talking to Christians go, except to try and be patient with them and try and not get mad. And
we'll bring it up to the contemporary trip in around 15 or 20 minutes. But let's stay in the 1640s for the moment, because you just reminded me another one of these various tendencies we're discussing was the Fifth Monarchy movement, who were apparently took as their piece of inspiration a verse in the book of Daniel, which foretold the coming of, you know, the God's reign on earth.
You know, Ben Johnson, he has a play called The Alchemist.
Uh-huh.
And he's laughing at making fun of all of it, and he says something about Fifth Monarchy Man and blah, blah, blah. But the Fifth Monarchy Man, I would call them badass Baptists.
Badass.
They were real revolutionaries, but they had theocratic tendencies.
Mm, they definitely seemed to have.
They liked Cromwell at first.
Mm-hmm.
But then they were still trying to keep the revolution going, and the experience of defeat. It starts with the levelers, then it goes with the diggers, then it goes with the ranters, then it goes with the Quakers. The Quakers wanted to march on Rome. The Quakers became quietists later on in the 1650s,
right,
after they were defeated.
Right. We think of the Quakers today as being very genteel, but they were real revolutionaries
back in
the 1640s.
They thought, this is God's at work, and God's on our side, and we're going to win, and the Pope is the Antichrist type of stuff. You know, all this was pretty bad for Ireland, by the way.
This was all very bad for Ireland, yes.
Christopher Hill has a nice piece. He has a book called A Nation of Change and Novelty, Radical Politics, Religion, and Literature in 17th Century England. And the one piece is called 17th Century English Radicals and Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
And for the most part, it's a pretty sad story. Some of the levelers...
A big divide and conquer play going on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if you think that the Pope is literally the Antichrist and those Irish will just do whatever the priests tell them, and invasions were actually launched from Ireland.
Yes.
So...
Royalist invasions.
Yes.
Yes. Were launched from both Ireland and Scotland. The Scots were actually on both sides in the war. They started out with Cromwell, and then they switched to the Royalists, if memory serves. But the Irish really, really got kicked around terribly by Cromwell, with the levelers unfortunately serving as his cannon fodder before they themselves were kicked overboard.
Yeah, well, a lot of the levelers, it was almost... He didn't call it punishment, but it was just like, you're going to Ireland.
Yes.
We're getting you out of the way.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So what about the Seekers?
They were, as far as I can tell, you know, Gerard Winstanley, some people say he led the Quakerism. I read that one bit where they refused to take off their hats before General Fairfax.
Yes.
And Winstanley started writing books in the mid-1640s, and at first they were strictly religious and theological, and the people who later became Quakers were reading those books. The Seekers were, you know, Baptists were interesting at first, too, and they would literally, one of the ranters got in trouble because he was always baptizing women a lot, and they were always naked, and wherever creek or river happens to be nearby, we'll call it the River Jordan, and we'll dip you in. So the Seekers were another kind of sort of left Puritanism. They weren't satisfied with what, you know, Calvin was saying or what the ministers were saying, and they were on a spiritual quest.
Well, this was all left Puritanism.
There was also something called
right?
the Family of Love that goes back to early 1600s. And they didn't believe the Bible literally. So they were pretty interesting.
Well, this was all left wing Puritanism, right? I mean,
yeah,
yeah. So
let me read you a little bit more about Gerard Winstanley's religion.
Please do.
For Winstanley, Christ was not a person. The biblical stories are allegories, not history. Whether there was any such outward things or no, he remarked nonchalantly, it matters not much. In a pamphlet written in his pre-communist phase, when Stanley explained that he preferred to use the word reason rather than God, because he had been held in darkness by the word God. Reason is the great creator, not a personal God beyond the skies, but the law of the universe which will ultimately prevail among all men and women. For Winstanley, the second coming is the rising up of Christ and sons and daughters. Christ, the spirit of reason, entering the hearts of all men and women, comes to set all free. Freedom is Christ in you. And what will reason tell us? Is thy neighbor hungry and naked today? Do thou feed him and clothe him. It may be thy case tomorrow, and then he'll be ready to help thee. Reason teaches cooperation, and the rising of reason in all men and women will lead to recognition of the necessity of a communist society. So then Christopher Hill writing. Here Winstanley drew in his own rudimentary version of what was later to be called the labor theory of value. No man can be rich, but he must be rich, either by his own labors or by the labors of other men helping him. If a man have no help from his neighbors, he shall never gather an estate of hundreds and thousands a year. If other men help him to work, then are those riches his neighbors as well as his, for they be the fruit of other men's labors as well as his own. Rich men receive all they have from the laborer's hand, and what they give away other men's labors, not their own.
Perfect.
So Winstanley wasn't threatening to take away the property of the rich, but he was saying, well, you got all those acres, but good luck working it by yourself. So he was proposing a labor strike, really.
Right, and
Chumbawamba puts him down for being committed to nonviolence.
Yes,
Yes,
I did. It didn't work out for them very well.
No. I got to read you the last words of Gerard Winstanley.
Okay, but as long as you mentioned it, what does, let's see, here's what it says in the liner notes of Chumbawamba. The diggers taught us, by nature of their example, that common and equal work without lords or masters can be a practical alternative to the robbery and inequality of capitalism. They also unwittingly taught us the folly of accepting the violence and destruction of the state without fighting back. And here is the saddest line, is that St. George's Hill, the most famous of the diggers' plots of squatted land, is now a highly select residential area full of well-to-do stockbrokers. Ay, ay, ay.
I mean, who knows where People's Park's going to be in 100 years, too. But.
Right, exactly. Anyway, so you were going to read to us... Winstanley's last words?
His last book published, The Law of Freedom in the Platform, or True Majesty Restored, by Gerard Winstanley.
Lay it on us.
And he's still a communist, but he's no longer an anarchist in this book, and it's got some creepy things in it.
Okay.
But he ends with this poem. Here is the righteous law, man. Wilt thou it maintain? It may be, is, as hath still in the world been slain. Truth appears in light. Falsehood rules in power. To see these things to be is cause of grief each hour. Knowledge, why didst thou come to wound and not to cure? I sent not for thee, thou didst me inlure. Where knowledge does increase, there sorrows multiply. To see the great deceit which in the world doth lie, man saying one thing now, unsaying it anon, breaking all his engagements when deeds for him are done. O power, where art thou that must mend things amiss? Come, change the heart of man, and make him truth to kiss. O death, where art thou? Wilt thou not tidings send? I fear thee not. Thou art my loving friend. Come, take this body, and scatter it in the four, that I may dwell in one, and rest in peace once more.
Wow.
Yeah. And then silence.
So, I thought that he died a Quaker, actually.
People think he joined the Quaker Church, and he may have even been elected like Justice of the Peace or something in the same area where he caused all this trouble before.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
All right, so what are the weird things?
He married into some money and actually owned some property towards the end of his life.
Indeed.
And, you know, he knew that, you know, when the time's right, try something, and otherwise just... nothing can be done.
All right, so you say there's some, like, weird things in his last...
For one thing, some ranters apparently showed up, and, you know, they caused a lot of trouble. I mean, there were married couples there. And then Lord Fairfax actually went to St. George's Hill and had a look around and said, can you show me every woman has a husband and blah, blah, blah. And also the ranchers thought, well, whatever you feel, do what you feel. If you don't feel like working, you don't. So Win Stanley's got ideas that everyone will be made to work. Here's something really creepy. It's kind of funny, too, though. He who professes the service of a righteous God by preaching and prayer and makes a trade to get the possessions of the earth shall be put to death for a witch and
Ooh.
A cheater.
Ooh.
So, you know who he's talking about? Like Oral Roberts and, you know, who are some of these other...
Right, these hucksters, yeah.
Yeah. They'll be, he doesn't say burn them at the stake or anything, but they'll be put to death as a witch.
All right, so there's, from the sources that I've read, there's actually some conflict as to who crushed the diggers. Some people say that it was, Oliver Cromwell's army, and others say that, Lord Fairfax went out there and kind of tried to intimidate them, but then left, and it was the local landowners who kind of raised their own private militia and put the diggers down.
Well, there was the main preacher from the area hated Gerard Winstanley. He had a living. He had he was the kind of person Gerard Winstanley thought should be put to death as a witch.
All right, so then this preacher... This preacher would have been a Puritan, or...
He was a Presbyterian.
Presbyterian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Helen Brimstone kind of guy, apparently. Mm-hmm. And bugging Fairfax to do something about these guys, and Fairfax sent some troops, and they went, and, you know, there were a lot of, like, people who fought for Fairfax at Naseby that were now diggers.
Right.
So they didn't really have the heart to do it, and they just thought, well, and it really was kind of a joke anyways. I mean, here's your little turnips and stuff. they show up and say, this is the revolution that you're so scared about?
Right.
This little measly thing here?
Mm-hmm.
But that's why it was by the time they started, it was already too late. Because the property owners, they were terrified of leveling.
And leveling meant what?
Leveling meant there's not going to be any rich people and there's not going to be any poor people.
Right.
There's not going to be any mountains and not going to be any valleys.
Right. And in a more literal sense, it meant that, you're going to get your manors burned down.
Well, I mean, they took it that far in their feverish minds, yes. I mean, sure, they could have got, I mean, Gerard Winstanley didn't want any kind of violence. It's
right.
Just withhold your labor.
Right.
But, things get a life of their own, so who knows?
Well, I think that's sort of the origin of the word leveling, whether it was, a mere sort of Red Scare propaganda thing or if it was actually, again, the levelers themselves rejected the term. But apparently, it meant that, you're going to get your manners leveled to the ground.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway.
Oh, I should have brought this book. I have tons of books. I have a book, a collection of leveler writings, and... One of the levelers, Walwyn, really was actually a communist, and he said, things will never be right until everyone is equal. And then someone says, is this possible? And he says, we must endeavor it.
Mm-hmm. So Winstanley survived the crushing of his group, of his followers.
Yeah, their houses were turned down and torched, and their crops torn up. And, I mean, they were people... The local gentry would hire thugs to beat them up and stuff.
Yes.
So, but I think only one died, as far as I know. I think there was a miscarriage. A woman, a pregnant woman, was beat up, and there was a miscarriage.
But
I mean, it was horrible.
They were dispersed, as the song goes. Yes.
Yes, and there were actually 10 different digger colonies at one point around England.
Mm-hmm.
And they were getting the word out. Oh, and some ranchers went around making a collection saying it was for St. George's Hill. And they kept it.
Ah.
And Winstanley found out and thought, what? People would really support us? And then they tried too.
All right, so let me throw out another couple of names of tendencies out there. Well, as we've noted, the levelers didn't actually call themselves levelers, although history has given them that name, which began as a pejorative. They called themselves agitators.
Well, the agitators they were mostly in the cavalry, and some of the levelers were not in the army. Like Lilburn was living in London, but so the agitators and the levelers were working together, and the agitators were able to, because they were on horseback, they could distribute the pamphlets everywhere.
All right, and what about the larger category, which encompassed a lot of these tendencies, was the dissenters.
Right. I mean, the dissenters, you know, we should talk about enclosures. You know Shakespeare was involved in enclosures?
No, do tell.
And I don't know really all the details, and Cromwell's big thing was draining swamps.
Right.
And this is the saddest thing to me, because they called the enclosers themselves called themselves improvers.
Mm-hmm.
And Winstanley's got a little bit of this improvement type stuff going, like the wastelands. We'll make the wastelands grow.
Yes.
I mean, he's got some, a little bit disturbing too, and it's almost like Locke in a way. It's kind of like, it's no one's using it, therefore we can use it. Like the Native Americans, they're not using it. You know what I mean?
Right, but this is common land, which, you know, was being enclosed. That is to say, you know, the traditional inhabitants, the peasants going back to feudal times, were being kicked off of it.
So just think of this swamp. Like, oh, you go out there and you catch crayfish and you go fishing and you hide. If the police are looking for the constables after you, they'll never find you in the swamp.
Right.
And then here's Cromwell draining all the swamps and putting fences around them.
Yes.
And stuff.
Yes.
So that's the kind of thing that was going on. Are you familiar with this book called Caliban and the Witch?
Yes, by Sylvia Federici.
So this is kind of the tail end of that period of, what's that term, primitive accumulation.
Mm-hmm.
And then she ties it all in with the witch burning and stuff.
Yes.
So there was a period of intense witch burnings in England a couple years before 1649. There, in fact, I'd call it a horror movie. It stars Vincent Price.
Mm-hmm.
And it was called The Conqueror Worm or something. It was Roger Corman, and they were having hits with movies that had titles out of Edgar Allan Poe. And the original was called The Witchfinder General. And it was these two guys that were going around England finding witches. And they even had Cromwell even gave them a certain official sanction. And when I found out about these two, and I realized, wait a minute, I saw that movie with Vincent Price, and I just thought it was a bunch of made up. But it's actually a very intense and good and disturbing movie.
Hmm.
So that'd be the 1640s movie double feature, The Conqueror Worm and then Winstanley.
Ah, there you go. Well, we should set up a big presentation for you and show both those movies and then have you give your exegesis afterwards.
That'd be fun.
So, all right, but what The diggers were doing in terms of reclamation and making the waste ground grow.
They were big on manure. They wanted that. One third of England is unmanured. but look, I mean, our version now is like worm castings and stuff, right?
Right. Well, I was thinking of Adam Purple. You know Adam Purple, right?
Well, yeah. He's a modern day Gerard Winstanley.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
But what Cromwell was doing was very different. I mean, you know, draining the swamps and so on. They weren't doing anything as ambitious as that. They were just, you know, all of the good land was being taken over at this point by, I mean, you know, the lords already technically owned it, but the peasants had their ancient rights and customs, by which they, you know, had the right to occupancy and cultivation of the lands. And now this was being repealed in the enclosures and the land was being turned over to sheep for the wool market. Sheep eat men, right? So the diggers were attempting to, you know, take some land which was unused, so they wouldn't actually have to, you know, go up against the landlords with force of arms, and could still, you know, sort of create their alternative society in the vacant lots of the old, just as, you know, Adam Purple and the people who built People's Park.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Have I got that right?
Yeah. Have you heard of Peter Linebaugh?
Yeah, sure.
He was on KPFA today.
Oh, we're talking
they
about
were talking about Magna Carta, because it was during the Sotomayor hearing.
Oh, really?
And then there's another, the forestry laws that happened at the same time that didn't make it over this country, but who's the king, Richard, or the evil nemesis of Robin Hood guy that signed Magna Carta?
Well, no, you're getting two historical figures mixed up, I believe.
No, that same guy.
Well, it was King John Lackland who...
Yeah, King John, exactly. Yeah, yeah. King Richard was the guy Robin Hood liked.
Exactly, King
and
Richard
III.
He was
III. At the Crusades, yeah. And John was reigning.
That's right, yeah. Is that how it worked?
Yeah.
Maybe,
So, apparently there was forestry laws that he was forced to sign, too, because he was trying to kick all the common people out of the commons.
That's
and
right.
It was enshrined in law in this forestry charter or something, also signed by the same king that signed the Magna Carta, which is now disappearing, starting with Clinton, according to Peter Linebaugh.
Started with Bill Clinton.
Yeah.
Well,
they apparently really weakened habeas corpus. And
well, not half as much as Bush did, quite
obviously.
Yeah,
well, that's the coup de grace, I guess.
Not a fraction as much as Bush did.
But, so how are we doing on time? And when there's a few modern-day things I'd like to talk about. We already got as far as Adam Purple.
Yes, indeed. All right, I do want to bring it up to the modern day, but I should take, since you asked about the time, very apropos, I should take this opportunity to state that it's 1 o'clock in the morning on listener-supported, non-commercial, WBAI 99.5 FM here in New York City. My name is Bill Weinberg. This is the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade, and we are joined by telephone live from Oakland, California, with independent radical scholar Lou Finzel.
Hey, when are you going to play Leon Rosselson?
We could do that immediately if you want.
Yeah, we should do that.
But maybe just real quickly, there's two more tendencies I wanted to throw at you.
Okay.
Just because their names are so irresistible.
Uh-huh.
How about the Grindletonians?
I don't know anything about them, but I think Grindleton was a town.
That's true.
Muggleton was a dude.
Right, the Muggletonians.
The Muggletonians are named after a dude, and the Grindletonians I've heard of, but I don't really have any information on.
Oh, well, tell us a little bit about the Muggletonians. I know they were your favorite.
Well, they're kind of creepy in certain ways, but they were the... So Win Stanley ended up as a Quaker...
Mm-hmm.
And Clarkson, his ranter nemesis, ended up as a Muggletonian.
Mm.
And the Muggletonians, they were really against the Quakers because they were so much like the Quakers that they had this kind of almost like two Trotskyist sects having it out.
Uh-huh. Yeah, but the Quakers weren't into the whole British Israelite two-seed trip that the Muggletonians were into.
Well, there was an incredible amount of overlap between ranters, Quakers, Muggletonians.
Yes, it was all sort of a soup.
And they sorted themselves out, but they couldn't even tell themselves apart for a long time.
Right, but it was the Muggletonians who were really into the two-seed theory and the British Israelite notion, right? That the ancient Brits were actually the ancient Israelites, which is a theory which lives on in the really sinister racist element of the radical right in this country today. Ironically, given that these were all like real populist movements of the left back in the 1640s.
I mean, it's hard to know what to make of the Muggletonians because they appeared when now it's really time for quietism, and the Quakers were just saying, don't mess with, just mind your own business as far as you can.
Right, keep your head down.
Be
pious.
The Muggletonians decided that Cain and Abel, the serpent had actual sex with Eve and impregnated her with Cain. Adam has the seed of God, so Adam was the father of Abel. But Abel got his head caved in. So the next one is Seth. So Seth, there's the seed of, it's called the seed of the woman for some reason, and the seed of the serpent. So there's no God. God is only within human beings, and the devil is only within human beings. So that's the two-seed theory.
Right, which is today...
So the white racists have it that Jews and blacks are the seed of the devil.
Exactly,
Mm-hmm. And, you know, they probably thought of this on their own, but maybe there's a link. I mean, some Muggletonians probably
England. No, I think there is some continuity between, the old... 17th century British Israelite tradition and the what do they call themselves today? The two-seed theory on the contemporary radical right?
Oh, the Christian identity.
Christian movement. Identity movement, precisely, yes. I do believe there is an actual continuity between them. Okay, well, this is moving into precisely where we want to take the conversation next. So why don't we take a brief musical break, and then in the remaining 20 minutes, we'll talk about, your presentation is entitled, Can We Still Turn the World Upside Down? Lessons from 1649. So we'll bring it up to the present day and talk about what all of this seemingly obscure stuff means for contemporary America. After we hear a little bit from Leon Rosselson. Actually, this is Leon Rosselson's song, Whoops, The World Turned Upside Down, as interpreted by Dick Galgan. Wait a minute. Have I got this queued up correctly? Maybe I don't. Here we go. I actually want cut. Forgive me. Wasting time. Cut 9. Okay. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9.
In 1649 to St. George's Hill, a ragged band they called the Diggers came to show the people's well. They defied the landlords, they defied the laws, they grabbed the dispossessed, reclaiming what was theirs. We come in peace, they said, to dig and sow. We come to work the land in common and to make the wasteland grow. The self-divided we will make whole, so it can be a common treasury for all. The sin of property we do disdain. No one has any right to buy and sell yet for private gain. By theft and murder they took the land. Now everywhere the walls rise up at their command. They make the laws to serve them well. The clergy dazzle as we have an honey damason to hell. We will not worship the God they serve, the God of great who feeds the rich while poor men starve. We work, we eat together, we need no sort. We will not bow to masters or pay rent to the lords. We are free men, though we are poor. Ye diggers all, stand up for glory, stand up now. From the men of property the orders came. They sent the hired men and troopers to wipe out the diggers' claim, tear down their cottages, destroy their corn. They wear the spare stone, lay the vision lingers on. Ye poor, take courage, ye rich, take care. The earth was made a common treasury for everyone to share. All things in common, all people one. We come in peace, the order came to cut them down.
All right, The World Turned Upside Down, as Leon Rosselson's song about the diggers of 1649, as interpreted by Dick Galgan sometime in the 1980s, I believe. So, we've got just about 20 minutes left. Lou, can we still turn the world upside down?
Hey, let's imagine a conversation 100 years from now, and someone starts talking about the Protestant Reformation.
100 years from now.
Person brings up the Protestant Reformation, and his friend says, which one, the big one or the little one?
Mm.
And he starts talking about Martin Luther and Erasmus and Henry VIII. Oh, you mean the little one.
as opposed to?
The one going on now.
Indeed.
Like Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses all over Latin America, formerly completely Catholic, all mm-hmm. over Africa.
Yes, yes.
So we're in the midst of a huge... There's more Christians alive now than there ever were.
Of course.
So... all the tendencies within Christianity are going to pop up.
Yes, but in a different form. I mean, this is exactly what I was trying to get at, is that, Puritanism in the 1640s played to the left, and today, quite obviously, it plays to the right.
You know, William Jennings Bryan was a populist.
Of course.
He was a fire breather. He was all for, the poor and leveling and everything.
Yeah, and repealing the gold standard. And
I mean, that wasn't that long ago.
Right, and he also was on the wrong side in the Scopes trial.
Yeah.
Exactly. Perfect example of what I'm talking about there. So, but that's very interesting, because he was kind of the transition there, right? Between, the old sort of left-wing Puritanism and the contemporary right-wing Puritanism. I mean, he kind of had a foot in both worlds. I mean, economically, he was a populist, but he had the cultural conservative thing going on, which sort of put him on the wrong side of progress in a lot of ways. Now, the key turning point, I would argue, was 1980 with the, Faustian bargain of the Reagan administration and the new right, where the Puritan instinct in American culture was sort of bought off by playing to the cultural conservative agenda, in the interests of corporate power, right? And in the interests of economic conservatism. Now, of course, a century ago, what we today call economic conservatism was then, economic liberalism, right? The notion that there should be no restraints on free trade and corporate power. And then they were struggling to break free from the restraints of mercantilism and the king. Whereas today they're struggling to break free from the New Deal and environmental regulations and socialism as they see it.
Aren't they in huge disarray now?
Yes, thank goodness they are in huge disarray now. Absolutely.
So who knows? Hey, I want to read you something now from a book published in 2003.
Okay.
And it's called All Over Creation.
Uh-huh.
It's by Ruth Ozeki.
Mm-hmm.
You ever heard of her?
No.
She wrote another novel. This is a novel. She wrote a novel called Our Year of Meats.
Hmm.
I didn't read that one. But she's great. So, this story, there's a character, Frank, and he's going to work at McDonald's or Burger King one morning, and he sees this freakazoid bus parked in the far corner of the parking lot. He's there at like 4:30 a.m. or 5 a.m. And they say, can we have your grease? Because they're this biodiesel. They're running on vegetable grease or whatever. He says, we just changed it. And they pull out a dead rat and say, just say you found this. So he ends up getting on board the freakazoid vehicle and joining up with this radical tendency. So I'll read you about this.
Mm-hmm.
Frisco was effing awesome. Frank had never seen anything like it. They crashed at an anarchist house in Oakland. A badass scene with people cruising by and hanging out in the kitchen and camping on the floor.
You were probably there.
I'm here right now. The Seeds knew everyone, and all these people were their friends. Frank was wary at first. He knew about group homes. But within minutes, he felt welcome. He was happy to be away from the effing farm. They hook up with this fundamentalist preacher or this farmer in Idaho who's against biogenetically engineered seeds and things.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this alliance between these anarchists and this religious fundamentalist farmer in Idaho.
Mm-hmm.
But he's glad to be out of Idaho for the time being.
Mm-hmm.
Geek handed him a spade and a garbage bag full of composted manure, and the next thing he knew, he was toting the shovel and the poop and a 5-foot peach sapling through the dusky streets of Oakland. He followed the crew, dressed all in black, to a median strip in the middle of a busy road. They scoped the area for signs of the man, and then the leader gave the word to dig. Frankie had gotten pretty good at digging and generally hated it, but this was different. Here in the twilight, under the streetlights, with traffic moving by him in both directions, it was exciting. Quickly, he broke the sod in a neat circle and excavated a 3-foot hole, then gently lowered his peach tree into the center. He filled in the hole with soil and the compost he'd been packing, tamped it down and mulched it. The leader looked at his work and nodded, "Right on, dude. You know your stuff." Down the street, the rest of the crew was planting other trees, a pear, a persimmon, some nut trees, and a couple of figs. In a few years, they'd be bearing fruit. food for the people, the leader had explained. Now, she's confused about this leader stuff, because that's not exactly how we do it. They were liberating traffic strips and other public land sites across the city. As long as they were neat, the city workers never noticed. Mostly, they just mowed right around the trees. When the 8 saplings were planted, the crew shouldered their shovels, and the timing was unreal, because a moment later, the automated irrigation system on the medium strip kicked in, and it was like a welcome-to-the-neighborhood party for the new transplants. The crew high-fived, then slipped into the shadows. "We're hacking the landscape, dude," they told Frankie, "bringing back the commons. We are politically opposed to lawns." They had torn up the lawn in front of their house and planted a vegetable garden. They kept bees in the backyard. They reclaimed straw bales from the racetrack to use as mulch and ran bicycle posses across the city to tend the vegetable garden they planted in the yards of elderly neighbors.
Yippee.
I'm here, by the way, right in this very house. In a minute, I want to put Terry Campos on the phone and let her talk to you a little about the People's Park.
Okay, great, please.
Hang on, just a little more.
Yeah.
They did puppet shows for kids, planted butterfly gardens. They hacked the plumbing of the house, rerouting the runoff from the showers and the sink until filtration ponds in the garden. They grew water lilies and bulrushes, willows and water chestnuts. They wanted to farm edible catfish one of these days, but for now they're raising huge ornamental carp for the Chinese market. Golden Luckies. Two-toned Prosperities. They made seed bombs to lob over barbed wire fences into the tightly cropped lawns of military installations and corporate headquarters. Packed with the seeds of native flowers, the bombs would take root and grow, little clumps of vegetative anarchy. This was agriculture that Frankie could get his head around, guerrilla gardening, defiance farming, radical acts of cultivation. Dudes, Frankie said, pacing up and down the Sputnik one night. That's their rig that they drive around in. This crap is awesome. How come you're not part of the scene? Why smiled. We are. We started this house. Frankie stopped short. So how come you left then? Time to move on, Geek said, rubbing his glasses. We're a network of cells, Frankie. We're part of the underground. There are houses like this in cities and towns all across the country. The Sputnik's one of the links, keeping people connected, you know? Keeping information and energy flowing, but most of all working on outreach. It's all about dissemination, Frankie. Dissemination? We're like a seed bomb, dude.
So, all right, now, what you're reading from what again? Tell us the name of the
all
book.
All Over Creation. Author Ruth Ozeki.
Right,
author
this is
My Year of Meats.
This is ostensibly a work of fiction.
Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, things have not actually advanced quite to the point that you're describing here. So when you say that, you know, this is your house, was it literally based
on
your house?
Well, it's not my house. It's the Purple House, you know, the Frog Church House.
Is it in fact based on an actual house?
Well, it's the same.
You think it is?
There's a number of houses. I mean, I'm sure it's a composite.
Huh.
I'm sure this is one of them.
Mm.
I mean, I don't think the bees are here anymore.
Mm.
One of the people that started this house, I gave him a copy of Avant Gardening after I read it.
Oh, yes.
And I kind of wish I hadn't, because now I can't even remember it. But
you can't remember what?
What all's in your book, Avant Gardening? Hey, you know this book, Nowtopia?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, we
how
had
pirate programmers, outlaw bicyclists, and vacant lot gardeners are inventing the future today.
By?
Oh, yeah, Chris Carlson.
Who we had on this radio show a few weeks back, yes.
So, but now, I want to read you one more thing, and then I'll put Terry on the line.
Yeah,
this
our book,
something
my
annoying.
Book, I should say, the book that I co-edited with Peter Lamborn Wilson, Avant Gardening, Ecological Struggle in the City and the World, it was dealing with similar sorts of eco-utopian fantasies about what New York could be if some of these ideas were put into practice. And
in this book, who's the what guy that did the cover?
I can't recall to tell you
Nowtopia.
The truth. Yes, Eric Drucker.
Yeah, Eric Drucker.
Yeah.
Pretty nice book.
And I also, on the annotation tip here, the book I was trying to remember by Ursula K. Le Guin, which is about this sort of utopian vision of California 100 years hence, is always always coming home.
Oh, okay, right, yeah. Right. So there's an issue of The Nation, and on the cover it says, Reinventing Capitalism, Joseph E. Stiglitz. Then it says, Reimagining Socialism, Barbara Ehrenreich and Bill Fletcher Jr. with Tariq Ali, Rebecca Solnit, Emanuel Wallerstein, and Bill McKibben.
Well, those aren't necessarily the figures I would choose to represent socialism, but
so there's this long piece by Barbara Ehrenreich and Bill Fletcher Jr., and then Rebecca Solnit writes this response that's really kind of annoying in a certain way.
Well, much that you read in The Nation is, but let's not go there.
Barbara Ehrenreich and Bill Fletcher write mournfully that there's supposed to be a revolution. But there was and is a revolution, just not one that looks like the way socialists and a lot of 60s radicals imagined it. The Sandinista revolution 30 years ago may well have been the last of its kind. The revolutions that have mattered since have been less interesting in seizing and becoming the state than circumventing it to go straight to becoming other people doing other things without state permission.
Well, I'm kind of with that, like the Zapatistas.
The 15-year-old Zapatista Revolution,
well, there you go.
Which never sought state power and, though badgered constantly, was never defeated, is a revolution for our time.
Yeah, yeah.
Really only the most dramatic of countless thousands involving Native Americans and Indian farmers and South African cooperatives and Argentinian workplaces and European utopian communities.
Okay, good.
In the United States, the most obvious realm in which this has transpired is food and farming. Organic, urban, community-assisted, and guerrilla agriculture are still small parts of the picture, but effective ones, a revolt against what transnational corporate food and capitalism generally produce. This revolt is taking place in the vast open space of Detroit, in the inner-city farms of West Oakland, in the Victory Gardens and public housing of Alemany Farm in San Francisco, and Growing Power in Milwaukee and many other places around the country. These are blows against alienation, poor health, hunger, and other woes fought with shovels and seeds, not guns. It's the same Winstanley stuff.
Yeah.
At its best, tending one's garden lends to tending one's community and policy, and ultimately becomes a way of entering the public sphere rather than withdrawing from it. Do we have a plan, people? Ehrenreich and Fletcher ask. We have thousands of them being carried out quite spectacularly over the past few decades for gardens and children, child care co-ops and bicycle lanes and farmers markets and countless ways of doing things differently and better. The underlying vision is neither state socialist nor corporate capitalist. Something humane, local, and accountable. Anarchist, basically, as in direct democracy. The revolution exists in little bits everywhere, but not much has been done to connect its dots. We need to say that there are alternatives being realized all around us and theorize the underlying ideals and possibilities. But we need to start from the confidence that the revolution has been with us for a while and is succeeding in bits and pieces. Enlarged and clarified, it could answer a lot of the urgent needs that the depression brings. If anarchists and neoliberals had one thing in common, it was an interest in shrinking the state that socialists hoped would solve things. Right now, nothing but that state exists on the scale to drag us back out of what the corporations and international markets dragged us into. But one of the questions for the long term is about scale. Small isn't always beautiful, but big beyond accountability or comprehension got crazy as well as ugly. So that's her contribution to the debate.
All right, well, I mean, why do you find that irritating?
I'm not satisfied. I mean, it's a little bit going great.
It's a little bit bubbly and over-optimistic, yes, but she's certainly articulating the very sort of vision that you've been talking about for the past hour and a half.
Well, I mean, that's why I read it when we're talking about the living tendency similar to the 1640s.
Yeah.
It's just that I'm hoping it's going to bust out. We haven't tore up any street. I mean, I want half of every street to be one way and the other half to be, you know, fruit trees.
There you go.
Gardens.
All right, listen, Lou, we only have 10 minutes left. So if you're
Terry has a book coming out about People's Park.
Lay it on us. Yeah.
Hey, hi.
Hey, Terry.
How's it going?
Pretty good. How are you?
I'm good.
Terry Compost. Is that the name you choose to go by?
Yep.
Okay. So you have a book coming out about People's Park.
Right. Even some downtown journalism of yours is quoted in it. It's a collection of quotes and photos and art to try to capture the story, pass it on to the next generation.
What's it going to be called?
People's Park Still Blooming.
Uh-huh. And have you got a publisher?
It's going to be published by Slingshot Collective that does the newspaper and the organizer. It'll be their first book.
Terrific. And when can we expect it out?
End of August.
Oh, great. Well, we should get you back on these airwaves to talk about it in greater detail.
All right. I threw in the last page, too, of a do-it-yourself parks and gardens so that we can carry on this conversation when we talk about the book. So.
Uh-huh.
Let 1,000 parks bloom. The earth divided we shall make whole, so it will be a common treasury for all. I'm reading off the back page.
So what do you want to tell us now about People's Park, Terry?
Well, it's still going. It's, you know, it's kind of miraculous. I mean, it's still a struggle. The University of California is kind of busy eating up the rest of Berkeley right now. So it's a little bit stressful watching them in action. But the park still remains, and it's still a strange sort of free zone and a place where, you know, homeless people can rest their bones without too much harassment, and a lot of sharing goes on, and it's, you know, it's still kind of special in its own way.
So. And still officially under a very unique policy of user development, recognized by the city of Berkeley as such.
It was landmarked, and that was part of its, yes, its recognizing that user development was a part of it.
When was it landmarked?
I think it was the late 80s.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And that was part of the landmark status, was that they recognized the user development aspect of it. Of course, there's this, you know, whole battle of, you know, the university thinks that they own the land still, and it's a dynamic tension.
Yes.
Right. So, yeah, the University of California has been pretty alarming over here. It's bold movements forward and discouraging its, you know, now entered. It's gallantly saving the planet by trying to, has a big deal with British Petroleum.
Right,
biofuels, yes. Which in my mind is a big step in the wrong direction.
Definitely.
If only they could research a usable public transit,
right.
That would be helpful.
Yeah. So what happened to the whole struggle over the trees that you were trying to save up there where they wanted to build some sports facility?
Yeah.
How did that end?
It ended.
You actually occupied the tree trunks for.
There was a tree sit, urban tree sit that went on here for well over a year and slowed down the project. But they ended up physically evicting everybody. They had to build this huge scaffold for the last holdouts. These four brave young men and cut down the trees.
They did cut down the trees.
They're busy trying to build their gymnasium.
Wasn't there some kind of concession that was wrested from them in exchange for ending the tree sit? Didn't they agree to some degree of community involvement in their development plans in the future or something like that?
They did in the heat of the moment, but then afterwards they...
Right. Yeah, typical story.
right.
Well, it's still very impressive that you guys occupied those trees for over a year.
It was a gallant stand, and you have to sort of look back and say, well, you know, when you see something foolish happening or, you know, evil in your community or something that needs to be spoken up to, you know, do you stand up to it even though your odds against Goliath are slim, or, you know, do you just ignore it? And I'm pretty proud of the community that bonded together and made the stand, and, you know, it's a tough just turn around, you know, the gears that are in action here.
Indeed. Well, in that spirit, you know, I'd like to go out with Leon Rosselson's version of You Noble Diggers All, Stand Up Now, Stand Up Now. So if we're going to play that, we only have like a minute or two left. So
let's do it.
What else do you guys have to say before we sign off here? On the question of whether we can still turn the world upside down and what the struggles of 1649 in England mean for us today in contemporary New York and Oakland and Berkeley and America.
Well, I mean, I feel like we have a better chance now than we've had in a long time.
To do what?
To make a big push and try and replace capitalism.
I agree.
It's ambitious, huh?
The system is certainly more discredited now than it's been since the 1930s, without a doubt. And there's more credence to socialistic and alternative ideas now than there's been certainly at any time since the 1970s, probably since the 1930s. So certainly a very opportune time for us to be looking back to the 1640s and the 1790s in France and the 1770s in the 13 colonies and other such periods of social ferment, and see what lessons there are to be gleaned.
Yeah, the War of Independence is over. The revolution continues.
Exactly. Well, Louis Finzel and Terry Compost, thank you so much for joining us tonight. It's been really fascinating.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
And Terry, let me know when the book comes out. Please send me a copy, and we'll get you back on these airwaves to talk about the People's Park struggle and history in greater detail.
All right.
So I'm going to leave you guys I'm going to leave you connected here while we play the Leon Rosselson so you can hear it too. But I'm going to say goodnight now because we have to be off the air in just 2 minutes. So to all of our listeners out there, please do stay tuned for Weaponry with Tom Whisker coming up forthwith after we hear Leon Rosselson playing the song that we played exactly an hour and a half ago, the Digger song, as written and presumably performed. Definitely the same words. Do we know if it's the same music, Lou, that Gerard Winstanley wrote back in 1649?
I mean, I have a feeling he took a common popular tune of the day and
yes.
said words to it.
Right. I've heard the same... The same tune used in other songs, actually.
Yeah. I bet they know that was the tune.
Yeah. Okay. Well, with that, we're going to go out with it. Thanks for joining us, Lou and Terry. And
good night, and keep the faith.
We're doing our best. Okay. And with that, once again, stay tuned to listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI. See you next week. And Salam Aleikum. Whoops. Is this the right one?
You yes. terrible diggers all, stand up now, stand up now. You noble diggers all, stand up now. Your wasteland to maintain, seeing cavaliers by name. You're digging to disdain, and your person's all defamed. Stand up now, diggers all. Your house is laid full down. Stand up now, stand up now.
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.